health is wealth, and this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast. I'm Susanna Steers.
And I'm Jillian McCormick. Sue, would you say most of your client base are women?
Yeah, I'd say probably 75% of the clients in my studio are women.
Yeah, mine too. As a pelvic health physiotherapist, most of my clients are female, as women are more likely to have pelvic health concerns in their lifetimes. It's about our anatomy and our biological job, that baby-making thing, our hormones. So while I do have men in my practice too, I'm quite happy to treat them. The majority of my clients are women, which is why I am thrilled to have pelvic health physiotherapist Sam Hughes here with us today to speak to us about some of the reasons why men might seek a pelvic health physio.
Sam has been a physiotherapist for 12 years and has worked in pelvic health for 10 of those years. Most of those years were in public practice, where she managed a clinical caseload while simultaneously implementing the pelvic health and prostate surgery physiotherapy program in Surrey, BC. She was also the principal investigator of a study in the area of incontinence after prostate cancer surgery. She's always been an advocate for promoting and disseminating pelvic health physiotherapy. Sam has spoken at many conferences, health practitioners' meetings, webinars, support groups, and client group programs. In the past 2 years, Sam has been transitioning her clinical work into private practice, where she recently joined forces with a wellness center to be able to treat men and women in collaboration with holistic practitioners. In 2019, Sam even published a book on the subject of men's health, called The Guide to Optimizing Recovery After Prostate Cancer Surgery. I have my book in hand. Welcome to the podcast, Sam. So glad to have you.
Oh, glad to be here too.
All right. I love an origin story. I always want to know the why of the journey, even when the answer is, as like in my case, because my mom told me it would be a good idea, which is literally the reason more or less why I went to physiotherapy school. Sam, what brought you to the profession?
Well, mine is actually a very long story, but to make it short, I was a graphic designer. I did my BA in industrial design in Rio in Brazil, and very artistic in nature, always danced, played instruments. So I thought maybe I should just do design, but I was also very into the business world and a feminist and wanting to be out there. So I said, well, maybe I shouldn't do just arts. I should do design because it's kind of a combination of marketing and art. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and I worked for about 10 years and mostly with web design. It was one of the first in my, my class to work with engineers and developing softwares and all of that. And I came to Canada and I opened a business and I was working along and trying to figure out how to find clients. So I had a consult with a holistic marketing person. And he asked me, he said, what do you love about your job and your profession? And I couldn't say a single thing that I loved about my job and my profession. Mm. So that really kind of, you know, oh my gosh, maybe I'm in the wrong area of practice, because I always like people. I'm very communicatively. I like to understand cultures. I like to merge into cultures. I always traveled, and that's kind of my basics of, okay, and I just hated computers, and I hated sitting in front of a screen. So I started my journey in terms of what should I do.
Yeah.
And I went back to Brazil, and I was kind of lost, and I did a few courses in reflexology, I did a anatomy course, and I kind of got fascinated by it, and I said, that's what I want to be. I want to be a physical therapist. So I came back, and I didn't realize it was a long journey, because, of course, my bachelor degree has nothing to do with it. So I had to go back to college, take 2 years in college, and then apply for physio school. And then I moved to U of A for my physio school.
Was that a bit shocking? Edmonton in the winter?
Actually, the first year wasn't too bad because it started snowing only in February. But then the next year started snowing in beginning of October and it didn't end until end of May. And it didn't melt until
Welcome
end of
to
May.
Alberta.
Yeah. And that's Sounds when I like decided, it. Okay, I'm going to go back to BC.
So incidentally, I also went to the University of Alberta. And I graduated with a bachelor's in PT. That's what it was at the time. So many good years in Corbett Hall were spent.
Yeah. And Dr. McGee.
Dr. McGee. Yeah. Shout out to Dr. McGee. Some really good orthopedic training there for sure. I was just thinking as I was preparing for this interview about the trudge from Corbett Hall to Torrey Turtle for that one class on the very other end of campus, which is almost not possible for the legs, the length of mine to get to in the amount of time that you have between classes. I think I was late for that class for an entire year. but I did love it in Edmonton. I loved the people. I'm actually an Alberta girl, so those winters were kind of in my wheelhouse. But I'm always interested to hear as well how imports to Edmonton adjust, shall we say.
Amazingly enough, there was tons of Brazilians in there. I couldn't believe it. They were all because of Dr. McGee's connection in Brazil, and they were all doing master's and PhD.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, what are you doing here? I thought I was the only crazy person to be here. But I actually enjoyed very much the university. It's a very good program, and I'm glad that I actually went there. So, and it was, for me, a very interesting Canadian experience. And I did see the Northern Light once, which was amazing.
That's pretty special.
And my husband had a, because I don't ski very well, but he had some cross-country skis. And I kind of ventured kind of into my backyard. There was like lots of snow, so I would do some cross-country skiing, which was pretty cool.
Well, public health is a subspecialty for physiotherapists in that you have to work to obtain skills through postgraduate courses. That's a pretty heavy commitment, I would imagine, of evenings and weekends and a rather different skill set than regular PT stuff. Can you tell us how did you get to be interested in pelvic health? What brought you there?
I was always kind of interested in pelvic health. I was brought up by my grandfather. And he was a gynecologist, and he died of prostate cancer. So you can understand now the connection.
Absolutely.
And he was quite amazing. He was very out of the box. He taught at university. He did a lot of research for uterine cancer. He actually developed a cold cauterized machine to prevent uterine cancer. So he would do that in their patients instead of prescribing antibiotics and all when there was like redness in the tissue, and he would do that. And there was lots of interesting slides because he also taught. So, you know, it was kind of the joke of the cousins, like, oh my God, don't go down there because you're going to see those slides. But when I started physio and I realized there was this women's health division and women's health courses, I was already wanting to have a placement in that area. But I realized that in Alberta is different. Like, you have to take the course prior to actually be able to have a practicum in that area. So I just didn't have time. It's a condensed program. So it's
super intense.
It's very intense.
The master's and PT is.
Yeah. And so kind of it was kind of in the side burner. And I was also very interested in urology. And I started working with rehabilitation in the hospitals. But I got injured quite a bit. And that's kind of what made me, okay, I have to find my niche and protect myself, right? So, I did the level one course actually in Alberta. I went back to Alberta and I did it there. And the year following to that, there was an opening in the same health authority that I worked for a continence clinic, and it would be in a new building, and they needed me to start right away to kind of help develop the section, the physiotherapy section, because it was all done by nurses before.
Okay.
And I was very interested because my creativity just, you know, I need to flourish.
The artist emerged.
Yes, and I was like, oh, that's so awesome. So I actually went back earlier. I was on mat leave, and I went back earlier for that. And it was an interesting route to take because I was very fresh into pelvic health. And so I did a lot of research. I just went to all the clinics that existed. I interviewed people and I wanted to see what worked, what didn't work. And at the same time, enhancing my clinical skills. And that's when I started seeing a lot of men. And I had no idea what to do with them because if you look at the literature, it's very iffy if even pelvic floor muscle training will help that population. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so that's how my interest started to become more flourished. And I just decided to apply for a grant for research in that area. So that's how it started.
We're going to talk a bit more about that study later on. But let's fill out for the people. What are the different skills that a pelvic health physio possesses? Like, when do you go see a pelvic health physio? Because I don't think everybody knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, not a lot of people know what we do, which is important that we continue to talk about it because it's a very important area. And as I just came from a sports congress 2 weeks ago, and first time ever there was a pelvic physio talking to ortho physios. Mm. And then I love what she said. She said, "I don't understand what's the taboo of talking about pelvic health. Everybody has a pelvis."
Yeah, exactly.
And we need to know what's going on down there because everybody has a pelvis. And so basically our training is as any other physios. We are all physiotherapists. And then afterwards, we do postgraduate courses in women's health. And now starting to have more men's health courses, which is great. But when I started, there was not many out there. And then what we learn how to do internal examinations. So and also understand urogynecological diseases and even able to address and assess some of them. So, for example, we are trained to understand what a prolapse is, how to grade a prolapse, how to treat a prolapse. And some people don't even know what prolapse means, but it's just really laxity in the tissue where you can see some of the pelvic organs kind of descending. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you see the bladder or you can see the uterus or you can see the rectum through the vaginal canal. And we are trained to do that. We are also trained to understand very well what how to assess and address pelvic floor muscle dysfunction. And it's a big, huge word, pelvic floor muscle dysfunction. But basically, there are muscles in internal that are our kind of the base of the pelvis. And they usually, to be able to assess them properly, you have to do a internal examination and palpation. And then you can see, are these muscles relaxed, at rest? Are these muscles contracting when they need to contract? And are these muscles weak or strong or too tight, not relaxing well? And so that's kind of the basics of our training. There's more to it, but I think we'll leave it at that.
I'm a little curious. I'm not a pelvic health physio. I'm not a physio at all. I've had the experience of having an internal exam, so I can picture very easily what that is like for a woman. Is it a very similar kind of exam for a man?
Well, the men only have one hole.
Well, they don't. Well, exactly. I mean,
so we have to go.
You're going up through the rectum?
Or, yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So we have to go through the rectum. Yes, okay. With them. A lot of coaching, right? Because
yes.
they don't know. When they come to see me, they're like, "Oh, you're going to do that to me?" I'm like, eventually, I would prefer to do that to you because that's really going to be more reliable in terms of being looking at him holistically and making sure that we kind of addressed all their muscles groups, right? Including the pelvic floor.
Exactly. These muscles are, it's a small but vital muscle group, and it is tucked up and inside our bodies. So looking at somebody from the outside, we can't actually tell how your pelvic floor muscles are functioning if we just look at you from the outside. And if you're doing a pelvic floor muscle contraction properly, no bones move. It's a very subtle thing. So doing that internal assessment, whether you're male or female, is vital to get all the information about the function of that muscle group. And yes, We are trained and skilled at introducing our patients to the concept, whether they're male or female, that they're going to have an internal exam at some point, we hope, and making sure that everybody's on board with that and comfortable with that assessment, as comfortable as you can be. Right.
Of course, there's always, you know, if the person is really adamant, oh, that's something I don't want to do, there's always things we can do from the outside. We can assess all the other areas that can influence the pelvic floor. And then hopefully that's going to help with their symptoms, right? And because sometimes I see some young guys and like 16, 17-year-old guys, I don't do internal examinations on them, right? Because it can be quite traumatic to them. And so we'll try our best to do behavioral therapy with them, address their diaphragm, address their hips and whatever it's causing their pelvic floor muscle dysfunction. Because sometimes there are things that are causing that dysfunction that not necessarily it's coming from the internal muscles, right? It can be coming from the external muscles as well.
And there's also biofeedback. So the use of using electrodes on the outside of the body to allow us some inference as to what's happening with the internal muscles, depending on where we place those electrodes. And that is another way of getting around doing an actual physical internal exam. It doesn't give us as much information, but if that's the only way that's going to be, that we're going to be able to access, that is a possibility. And there's also real-time ultrasound examinations that physiotherapists can be trained in doing to look at the action of those muscles on, say, the bladder. And for instance, and we haven't really covered it, but one of the things that happens if you do have pelvic floor muscle dysfunction is incontinence or leaking of pee and or poo, as well as prolapse, as already mentioned. People may also seek a pelvic health physiotherapist for problems with intercourse.
And erection problems as well. And also lack of libido. So sometimes in enhancing the circulation in the area can help with libido. And I actually had some really good success with ladies that are taking antidepressant medication and they just can't get an orgasm. And by just doing pelvic floor muscle training and addressing those muscles, they were able to have better sensation in the area, which was quite amazing to see. Mm-hmm. Ladies that haven't had any sensation for years, and then they started addressing that area, and they were quite successful. And
is there any data on that?
I don't know. It's all clinical basis.
All clinical. Fair
just
enough.
Giving you examples of.
Fair enough.
So, are you? I mean, Jillian noted earlier that a large portion of most pelvic health physios' caseloads are women. Is that true of you also, or are you strictly treating men in your practice?
No, I treat half and half. I see 50% women, 50% men. Occasionally, I would see more men. It all depends where the referral sources are coming from. I find that ladies are more in tune to searching for an answer and finding the provider and talking about their issues than men. Men usually come if the wife is kind of pushing them to come and see me or there's a referral coming from the urologists and they come. Yes.
Got it. And I'm also curious in what ways you mentioned that you do some collaboration with your colleagues of Holistic Health. Mm-hmm. What kinds of holistic practitioners do you collaborate with? And can you give us an example of how that works for your clients?
Yes. Yeah, so the clinic that I'm working now, we have about three naturopaths, one chiro, and she's actually a combo of chiro and naturopath. Mm-hmm. I have two acupuncturists and one, she does a lot of specialization in fertility treatments. So she sees a lot of, and then she follows up with them during pregnancy as well. Mm-hmm. And then we have a bunch of massage therapists, and they are quite amazing because some of them have training in osteopathy. So they're kind of different the way they're approaching their clients, and anyway, so we blend in very well because we kind of, you know, when I see someone that's coming to see me with pain, And then they are in a bunch of medications and they just have no energy. They have, they are older, they are depressed, they have risk of falling. So then I always tell them, you know, just consult with our naturopaths because they're pretty research-based and they can look at the medications and see if there's anything else they can give you that can help you with the symptoms. And then try to talk to the pharmacist and kind of look at the medication, maybe some of the medications that they are, you know, taking are also affecting their body, affecting their mood, affecting their balance. So that's one way. Another way is actually when I see menopausal women or premenopausal women with a lot of symptoms, then GI problems, you know, they call it IBS, but IBS is just symptoms, right? It's not really looking at what's causing those symptoms. So
that's irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah. And the naturopaths are really great to looking in. Why are you having the bloating? What are the foods that you are ingesting that are causing that? And another thing that I also refer to naturopaths is when they have bowel incontinence and it's actually diarrhea. And I usually tell them, diarrhea is not incontinence. Diarrhea, there's something wrong with your GI system and you have to address that. And they address that and that improves. Right?
Absolutely.
And the acupuncturists are also great when we, you know, when they're looking at, you know, I like acupuncture because I also practice with acupuncture because it looks at the person holistically as a whole as well. So there's so many things like mental health, anxiety, pain, all those kinds of things can influence pelvic health and vice versa, right? Vice versa. Good.
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic.
So let's talk about the guys for a minute. And for those of us who are not necessarily versed in pelvic health, what specifically are the reasons that a man might choose to come and see a pelvic health specialist?
Okay, so the younger males that I see usually come with a history of pain. So a history of pain in their scrotum or the tip of the penis. Or even like lower abdominal pain that was, you know, they tried a lot of different types of therapy and went and did tons of exams and it nothing. And then they went to see the urologist and the urologist says, go and see Sam. I don't know what to do with you.
Yeah. Everything's negative. All the ultrasounds, all the blood tests, all the everything, right?
Yes.
Yeah. All the scopes, and everything looks fine.
And their prostate seems fine, seems healthy. And they do a cysto with them, which is cystoscopy. They look at their bladder inside and the bladder seems healthy. So then it's kind of go and see Sam. Okay. And then a lot of the population that I see is the population that are diagnosed with prostate cancer and they are or going for and they choose to have the surgery, or I see them before the surgery, and then sometimes I see them after the surgery, and sometimes I see them before and after the surgery. And that's a population that's grown just because of the work that I've been doing since I started in the public clinic. Right?
And so they're coming, a lot of times they're coming post-op about incontinence, correct?
Yes.
And also erectile dysfunction. But just for a second, can we define what is incontinence?
So incontinence is an involuntary leak of urine. So it happens, you know, with movement. It can happen with a very sense of needing to urinate. And most of the time, the guy that had the surgery, they will have the incontinence that we call it stress urinary incontinence. Is the incontinence that there is increased intra-abdominal pressure, such as laughing, walking fast, changing positions very quickly, and then they leak. But there is also men that come after radiation therapy or even a combination of radiation and surgery, and then they'll have leakage with a strong sensation to urinate as well, and that's called urge incontinence. And sometimes they have both, and that's called mixed incontinence.
Perfect. So let's give people a description of the anatomy that's involved here in prostate cancer. Like, for instance, what is the prostate gland? Where is it? What does it do? Give us a prostate primer.
Okay. So the prostate gland sits in between these two valves that are called the internal urethral sphincter and the external urethral sphincter. And these two valves are basically the valves responsible for keeping the bladder, closing the tube, so then the reservoir, which is the bladder, can continue to stretch and maintain that reservoir there. And then the prostate is right in between those two valves and then inferior to the bladder. And its role is basically to produce this alkaline substance that will protect the sperm from entering the vagina, because the vagina is very acidic. And so it just kind of protects the sperm so it can actually live through fecundation, right? So that's kind of the role. So once the prostate is removed, they can still have orgasm, but it's called a dry orgasm because the fluid is not produced anymore. So then they don't have ejaculation, like they don't have that fluid coming out anymore.
So the prostate makes ejaculatory fluid that basically helps the sperm to get to where they're going during insertional intercourse.
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. All right. So prostate cancer is pretty common in Canada, would you say?
Yeah. In 2017, they had a number of 21, let me have a look here. I think it's 21,300 males were diagnosed with prostate cancer in that year.
Yeah.
And 47% of them actually had the radical prostatectomy surgery within that year of diagnosis. So yes, it is quite common.
I found a statistic online that said that prostate cancers will represent 20% of all the new cancer cases in men in 2019. So 20% of cancers in men that are diagnosed newly this year or last year in 2019 is prostate cancer. That's not a small concern. That's not a small number of men in Canada that will be impacted by this. I also found the stat that it represents 9% of all cancer deaths in men. And that too is a significant portion. So prostate cancer is not insignificant. And it's great to hear that there is more and more, I believe, research done. There are a few common types of treatments available. Maybe you could just speak to what are the treatments available?
Yeah, so the three most common treatments, there are other now that they're doing a lot of research on it, but I'm just going to comment on the three common ones. So one is, it's called the watchful waiting. So they're just looking at their blood work and if they have, and then they do a biopsy and they look and see if those cells are not reproducing as fast. So they call it the cancer that is growing very, very slowly. And their PSA, which is a marker in the blood that looks at prostate. It's a marker in the blood that gets higher once the prostate cancer is advancing, right? So they basically look at those markers and see if they are stable. And if they're stable, they don't do anything. They just wait and see. And once that changes, then that's when they start to, okay, let's treat this cancer. Yeah. So that's watchful waiting. Okay, and then the other one is the prostate cancer surgery. And usually they do a radical prostatectomy, meaning they just remove the whole entire prostate. There are many ways to get to the prostate. So there's retropubic, where they have an incision kind of in the front, the belly button down towards the pubis. And there is the robotic and the laparoscopic. So they just don't have a bigger incision and they go and get to the prostate that way. And then the third would be radiation therapy. And radiation therapy nowadays is mostly done by beam radiation. So they're trying to really localize and then make the radiation go into the prostate and try not to go around the prostate as much.
It's really getting specific to those tissues.
Yes. And in the past, they did, what's the name? Brachytherapy, which are these seeds that are implanted in the prostate. And nowadays, I don't see that as often. But I see a lot of men that had brachytherapy in the past and now are starting to have some bladder issues.
So I've heard of a concept, and the concept is getting clear margins. What is that, Sam?
Yeah. So the surgeon will have to have clear margins around the cancer to make sure that the cancer does not spread to other tissues. So it's very important for them to not just take the cancer out, but make sure that the tissues around the cancer, and that includes the prostate, right, and can include some of the nerves around it, and can also include some of the tissue around it. Now, the thing is that if the cancer is contained, then they are eligible for the prostate to the prostate surgery. But if the cancer is not contained in the prostate, then they have to go and do other therapies. Then they are not eligible to do the surgery anymore.
Got it. So you're clear.
So prostate cancer surgery is done for cancer that is contained in the prostate
within
tissue.
The prostate. And then they know that when they have the surgery, they have a good chance. There's no guarantees, but there's a good chance of getting all the cancer within that one procedure.
Yes.
Got it.
And then they are going to continue to make them do PSA tests to make sure that PSA is continued to be zero or like very, very low and not to increase. Because if increases after the surgery, then they know that it has spread. And so they are going to have to do other treatments such as radiation, sometimes chemotherapy, and then they usually put them in hormonal therapy. So basically, it's kind of putting the guys in menopause.
Right, right.
Yes.
Well, once the prostate gland is actually removed, if a man chooses that pathway or it works that they can do that, we've talked about the fact that the fluid for the sperm is no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
Is there damage to the urinary system based on where those sphincters that you talked about earlier?
Yeah.
What effects could that have?
Okay, so part of the clear margins, actually, they have to remove the internal urethral sphincter because that's actually part of the prostate tissue. You know, when you look at an illustration, it shows to be something different, right? But in real life, it's actually the same tissue.
Mm.
So that is removed with it. So now the man lacks one sphincter, right?
Okay.
And because the external sphincter is so close to the prostate gland, you know, hopefully not, but in small percentage of cases, there might be a little bit of damage there too.
Got it.
And so what happens is The bladder in guys, they actually has to contract quite forcefully for urination to occur because men has actually more obstacles than ladies. Okay, men has a very long urethral tube which goes all the way from the sphincter to the tip of the penis, right? Mm-hmm. And it also has that prostate in there that actually the tube actually goes inside the prostate. And most of the cases when they have the cancer, that cancer actually presses on the tube. So it is actually hard for the urine to pass through those to that part of the tube. So then basically before the cancer, the bladder is contracting quite forcefully for urination to occur. And then after the surgery, all those obstacles are kind of removed in a way. So the prostate is removed. There is going to be only one sphincter and the urethral tube is a little bit shorter because you have to calculate that the prostate actually contains the urethra in there too. So it's about 2.5 centimeters shorter as well. And it takes a while for the body to understand what's going on. And then the bladder, actually, there is some research that shows the bladder contraction is actually not as strong
than
before the surgery. So then that there's an adaptation there as well, just so men can become dry. And men become dry, which is amazing for me. because mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my gosh, all this happened to
all
you.
All this change.
And you're still able to cope quite well, which is very interesting.
No kidding.
It's totally fascinating. And it's one of the things that as a pelvic health physio that I feel like I struggle with, because when I have a woman in the office, I can absolutely relate to how it feels to have a bladder and a short urethra and a pelvic floor and a uterus that might be upset or bowels that might be upset and how that all works together. So I can phrase things in a way to her that she's like, oh, yes, yes, it's like this. And with the men, I always come up short with like, I have no idea how that feels to you when it's all intact. And so I don't know what to say right now to give you the appropriate analogy for how you might begin to sense the differences in your system. They know it's different and they know they don't have control and mm-hmm. they know it's distressing, but they don't. I feel like that's just something that I struggle with as a woman, is like, I don't quite know what to say to you at this moment to help you feel it better in your body.
Yeah, and you know the most interesting thing that happens to them is that the bladder neck is actually stretched down to be sutured back to the urethral tube. Okay. So they actually feel the urine going lower. And they actually think that they leaked.
Right. But they didn't.
But
that's
they didn't.
The almost leak.
But they didn't, because right down at the bladder neck, there's going to be the external urethral sphincter. And it's closed because the external, well, if it's working properly, right? And
right.
It's closed because it's a tonic muscle. It's only going to open once your brain tells, okay, now I'm right by the toilet and now I can urinate, and it's going to open. But with movement and certain activities, that urine can go lower because there is not that internal urethral sphincter anymore controlling that
right.
automatically, right? Mm-hmm. So they actually feel
it go lower.
Yes.
Yes.
And then they think they leaked. So they look at their pad and it's dry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what is that? So that's kind of that sensation.
That's what's going on?
A
disconcerting sensory experience.
Absolutely. And I just have always couched that as that's the almost leak, but you didn't leak. So you know,
yeah.
you have to learn how to navigate that situation of, was that a leak or an almost leak?
Yeah.
And it may not be an almost at all. They may have perfect control of that, but it feels so different. That's interesting.
So they wake up from the surgery. They have no prostate, and hopefully they don't have any cancer at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But likely they have incontinence. Is that after a prostate surgery, do you expect that a man is going to be incontinent? What is that like for them at the time? If they do have incontinence right after the surgery, is that likely to stay with them forever? Or what might make a man sort of think, okay, I better go get this looked at?
Mm-hmm.
And you said earlier that you have sometimes people come to see you before.
Mm-hmm.
Should they be assessed before the surgery just to see how they're doing?
Okay, so when they wake up from surgery, they're going to have a catheter in there for almost 2 weeks.
Okay.
Because first of all, you need that hole in there, right? Because if you don't have that hole, then you can't urinate. So then the idea is for the healing to happen around that hole. So
okay.
then you can urinate. Now, I am not sure if everybody that goes through surgery has incontinence, because a lot of the people I don't see, right, are doing really well. And according to the surgeons that I work with, they say a lot of them actually don't need anything. They just do really well after surgery. And I've actually seen a couple in the past, let's say 3-4 months, that did really well after surgery and hadn't had any incontinence.
Fantastic.
Now, if they have incontinence, it's kind of expected in a way because of everything that happened to them. But it's not that they are going to be suffering with incontinence forever. They just need to allow their body to heal. And how their body going to heal is the question mark, because everybody heals differently. So
right.
there is not really something that I can tell them, this is going to happen with you for sure, because I don't know, right? So some men do really well and they are dry in the first 3 months. Some men are still struggling for about a year.
Right.
Mm. Now, usually there is a kind of a positive curve when they're healing. So they will leak more in the beginning and they start to leak less after the months of healing starts to occur. There is some studies that look at how much they leak in the beginning. It's kind of it gives you kind of an expectation how they're going to do later on, you know, after the 6 months follow up. So if they're leaking a lot, they need a lot of pads, that's not a good prognosis. But I really look at research with a very curious mind, because they are looking at generally that's what's going to happen. But maybe whoever you're seeing is not that general. It's yes. It's going to be one kind of that's going to do well. So I never say that to them. Oh, okay, you're leaking a lot. Oh, I don't know about this, right? Like never. Because the other thing too is making sure that they have that positive approach to healing. And most of the time, that's why I see them prior to the surgery. They're very concerned. They're reading all these things online and they're like, oh my gosh, my masculinity, what's going to happen to me? And so I kind of give them, this is going to be a recovery process. And don't worry if there is a lot of incontinence in the beginning, because most of the time, men will recover from that. Mm-hmm. That's not how you're going to be, how you're going to be for the rest of your life. Most of the cases, they improve.
Excellent. We did touch on, and I do want to talk about, another possible side effect of surgery, and that's related to erectile function.
Yeah.
Can you tell us why do men who have the prostatectomies develop erectile dysfunction? Is it everybody? What can they do about it? Give us a bit of a synopsis.
Yeah. So there is these nerves called the cavernosus nerves, and they are the nerves that are responsible for sending that increased blood flow to the penis. So when they are performing the surgery, it all depends how the cancer is, right? Like if the cancer is an aggressive cancer and if the person is very young, it all depends. So they try to preserve those nerves as best as they can, but sometimes that's not possible. So if they cut the nerves, then they're not going to have a spontaneous erection anymore, right? They will need to have help with that.
Right.
Got it.
Now, if they preserve the nerves, because it's such a sensitive nerve, just with the swelling and the scar tissue around the nerves will cause the nerve to degenerate. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the nerves will regenerate again. And it can possibly regenerate again, but it takes some time to regenerate. So it can take about 6 to up to 4 years for those nerves to regenerate.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean, so that's the thing, like this is not going to be your final result, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that because you're not having erections at this moment, you're not going to be able to have them in the future if you had those nerves preserved.
Got it. And are there proactive things that men can do to help with that nerve regeneration?
Yes. Well, not the nerve regeneration, but they need to preserve their penile tissue, right?
Okay.
Lots of men complain to me. And so, okay, I don't know what happened to my penis, but it looks so much smaller. And some men actually have an innie, right? Like the penis actually goes inwards.
Inside the body.
Yeah.
Just a little, like dimple.
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't retract all the way inside. Yeah.
Okay. No,
think of it. It's still a penis, but it's got a little innie like a belly button. Now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah. And when I, you know, in the beginning of my career, I thought that was because of the surgery, because you know you're pulling the penis up towards the bladder,
the urethra,
and then yeah, but actually no, the urethra is attached to the bone, so there's no way you can actually pull the urethra up. Basically, the bladder has to descend to the urethra,
and that's why they pull down the bladder neck.
Oh. Yes. Now, what is happening is actually atrophy from lack of blood circulation and lack of of action, basically.
Right.
'Cause men, they have spontaneous erections at night for a reason.
Yes.
They have those spontaneous erections at night to maintain that penile tissue. So when they have, when they are aroused and they want to have intercourse, those, you know, the blood circulation will come to the penis and the penis will be able to expand.
Right, right.
But after the surgery, they're not going to have those spontaneous erections anymore. So they need to actually make sure that that penile tissue can expand and contract the way it should expand and contract. Once that blood circulation comes back, then they're able to have a full erection, right?
Got it.
So some doctors actually give them a very low doses of Cialis or Viagra for that reason, but it's still controversial because in the literature, it doesn't really say that it's helping erection in the future, right?
Okay. Okay.
But what I tell them is just more, it's simple. Like 3 times a week, you expand and contract your penis 10 to 15 times, making sure you're keeping that penile length healthy.
And they would do that manually?
Manually, yes.
Okay, kind of like a massage technique.
Yes. So from the base of the penis all the way to the tip of the penis and then contracting it down, right? So that kind of thing.
Yes. If you don't use it, you lose it. And this is a way to make the tissues do what they are meant to do, more or less, in a time when they might be a little bit more quiet. I love it. That's fantastic. Very proactive. And it gives the men something to do because what I've observed is that they feel a little bit hopeless about that. Helpless. There's nothing they can do. And yet, perhaps there is.
And not only because they don't have erections doesn't mean they can't have orgasm. So they can continue to be sexual beings until that erection comes about. And even if that erection doesn't come about, there's ways that they can actually promote an erection, mm-hmm. like, you know, using, you know, injections or pumps or anything like that. But they can continue to be sexual beings with their partner. There's no reason why they can't. And it's a very interesting idea for men because it's a very novel way of thinking about sexuality.
Absolutely. Right?
Because all they experience is like, this is me. It's my penis. That's my sexuality, but not necessarily it is. So it's kind of introducing that idea as well. So then they can have a notion that nothing is kind of all lost, right?
So give us an example of a typical client that comes into your office and what do you do for them? For instance, what's treatment?
So you're talking about the prostate cancer?
Yeah.
Okay. So if they come after surgery, I will sit with them and talk about, you know, their symptoms and I will explain what the surgery entails so they understand why they're having those issues. And then I try to figure out what's important to them because it's interesting. Like you can't, incontinence could be devastating for some people and could be okay for some other people. Right? The quantity of incontinence doesn't mean that that's translating into their quality of life or how satisfied they are, right? Some guys say to me, I don't care for erections. I'm actually pretty happy that I'm alive and I still want to live another 10 years and I have my granddaughters or whatever. But this incontinence is really bothering me, right? So then we look into treating the incontinence. Sometimes they will compensate because they're having incontinence. Now they're kind of urinating quite significantly because they don't want to have the incontinence, but that actually makes them worse. So I kind of talk about behavioral therapy with them in terms of let's look into spacing out urination. Let's look into what's healthy for the bladder. What are the things that can cause the bladder to be a little bit more overactive? So we talked about that. And then we do a kind of a total body assessment, right? So I look at how their spine is, how they're mobile, how the pelvis is moving. And then I look a lot at their abdomen as well, because there is a high percentage of men that will actually develop hernia after the surgery. And we don't really know why, if that's part of the surgical procedure, but there is a high risk of developing that hernia. So I usually try to address that as well, because abdominal wall is everything for, you know, translating the pressure throughout your body, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
And then I look and then I also address emotional health. I address see how well they are, you know, with their family and their community, how they're feeling towards all of that. If they feel isolated, if there's nobody that they can talk to about that issue, I usually recommend them to join a support group worker or even a support program in their area. So then they know they're not alone. And then we do evaluation of their pelvic floor. But it's not just about pelvic floor. I do much more than that. Sometimes pelvic floor doesn't even need to be addressed. We just need to do more relaxation and awareness, because they are holding into a lot of tension because they are kind of expecting that leakage to come. And right. they're really, really tight, and they're using those muscles a lot. And that's actually causing most of their leakage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I also saw that you've been involved in some research as well. And so for the science geeks among us, and I think that includes everybody in this room, can you tell us about what you studied and what you concluded from the study?
Yeah. So it was a pilot study, so a very, experimental introduction into a topic that it's really dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see how these men will do in a group format. And it's very innovative, because there's no research looking at that, because they think it's such a private thing to talk, to discuss in group, and that's not going to really cut it with men, because men is very reserved about their...
They're not going to talk about
it. Yes. And so then what I did have like a person that did all my... So it was a blinded assessor. So it was a pelvic floor physio, and she would assess all of them, and then have like I'll get that assessment in paper. So I wouldn't touch them, because then it wouldn't be fair with the group program, right?
Right.
And then I randomize them into the group program or the one-on-one program. And I did the same intervention with both the groups, making sure that their goal was actually a home program. Right. So then they had to kind of be involved at home with their program and come to see me as follow up. The group program came a little bit more frequent, just because I wanted to actually be able to individualize their treatment, because not everybody will need everything okay. from that treatment.
Okay.
But the one thing that I added in that, it was relaxation. Mm-hmm. So at the end of my one-on-one session or my group session, we did relaxation. To address some of the guys that actually in their assessment sheet had difficulties relaxing the muscles and all that. And so I did that with everybody to make it fair, right? And to make it standardized. And I also did the education part, the anatomy and the behavioral therapy with the two programs. I followed them after the 8 weeks, and then I followed them at 3 months and at 6 months post. And my main outcome measure was the ICIQ-SF score, which is it translates incontinence into burden of incontinence, which I really like, because it's not just about how much they're leaking, but how that leakage actually interferes with their life.
The effects on their daily life.
And, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And anyway, so the group program did better than the one-on-one.
Interesting.
And because the one-on-one, actually the ICIQ score was not significantly changed. The group program had some significant change, which is very interesting, because it's like, is it because they had that support and encouragement from the other peers, or even seeing that their problem is kind of common in a way,
right.
or mm-hmm. was it because they came to see me more often? So that's why we didn't publish the study, because it had some conflicting methodology.
Got it.
But after this, it changed the way I approached them, because then that's how I started my group programs with them.
So is that part of what in, you brought into what you were doing when you implemented the pelvic health and prostate surgery physio program?
Yes.
In Surrey?
I basically convinced the main urologist to to send me all their patients. First, I thought post-op. And then I thought, no, it has to be pre-op because they need that information prior to, because it, they had to wait so long to see me because in public practice, my waiting list was a year long, right?
Wow, yeah.
Okay. And so I wanted them to at least have the information, actually be assessed by me. So then they understand what it means to make, to do those exercises and if they actually needed to do those exercises. And also to have that body awareness, right? Because what was happening is that I would educate them. I would tell them what to experience, blah, 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 blah. And then they will come to see me. They're doing everything wrong.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
So then I implemented, okay, I'm just going to do the group format. And then everybody is going to go wait in the lobby with their little gown on and come and be assessed by me. Each individual of them. It was quite
this
fun.
This is quite a picture in my head.
Yeah, it's a picture in my head, too. And they agreed to do this with their little gowns. And
yeah.
They were all in there together.
All of them chatting with their little gowns, talking about their cancer experience.
I love it.
Yeah. That's really cool. That was a way that I was able to speed them into the process because if not, if just to see me one-on-one, they had to wait 1 year. But I didn't think it was fair for them to wait 1 year, right? While they're really struggling with trying to figure out what to do and getting where to find the right information and frustrated with the doctors because nobody told me this was going to happen to me, right?
Yes.
And so anyway, so that's how it started.
And do you still practice that way, in the way that includes groups, or was that purely for the study?
I had a group in White Rock, but it was very hard. It was very challenging for me because I had to be on top of the doctors. And you know, it's very different when it's paid and non-paid.
Got it.
Yeah.
And just to get them, I just think it's very, very helpful. I still encourage them to get into a group format. But unfortunately, privately, I just couldn't find a way that would make it happen as a flow because it was a lot of work from me trying to organize these groups.
Got it.
And so now everywhere. I'm just trying to figure out how can I get them to talk about these issues in a group format.
So I know there's something called the prostate cancer support groups. There's many of them throughout the Lower Mainland. If they do a Google, they can probably find a group near them. I know the one in North Vancouver has regular meetings,
mm-hmm.
And they get speakers in sometime. So that seems like a good way for these men and perhaps their families to go to get that kind of group.
Yeah. Not everybody wants to experience. Do that, though. That's
not everybody
the problem.
Wants to do that. Fair enough.
And then also, you know, I love them and I know most of the leaders, they are so enthusiastic. They know a lot about prostate cancer. But you can imagine how not everybody would have the surgery, right? Some right. guys are doing the watchful waiting. Some guys are doing the radiation therapy. So, and this group format was just for the
prostate cancer
surgery.
Surgery groups. Yeah. Okay. All right. I once read a post on Facebook from you where you expressed that you just finished some kind of an information night, perhaps, or a support group meeting where you spoke, and you admitted to feeling really touched by that experience. Something about the men sharing their stories, that you'd welled up a bit, maybe. Can you tell us what touches you?
Yeah, you know, it's very hard for men to open up, and it was funny because I was the only one that cried in the group. They're all looking at me thinking I was crazy. But for me, it is a sensitive issue, and I'm going to cry right now because I'm an emotional person. But anyways, you know, at first, when they are in that group, they are stiff. They don't know what to expect. Oh, my God, what she's going to talk about. I'm worried about this cancer. I don't want to be here. My wife actually told me to come, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's not a lecture. It's kind of a conversation. And everybody can express their feelings. They can ask for what direction they want that class to go. And I want to actually explain all the most important things about the surgery and the side effects and all. But at the end, we have this kind of conversation and this openness. And it was just so great to see that attitude change from the beginning of the class to the end of the class. And we talk a lot about emotional health, and because I find emotion is everything, and it translates into better recovery. Yes. If that can be checked and addressed. And we talked about how difficult it is to be diagnosed first with prostate cancer, and also realizing that they're going to have these issues that affects their masculinity and how they see themselves as a man. That's really hard. Like if you look at research studies, incontinence in ladies and incontinence in men, and the man will have a much lower quality of life than women having the same type of incontinence.
Okay.
Because for them, it's like they never think about wearing pads in their lives. Like this is very demeaning to them.
So normalized for women.
Yes. And the other is, it's expected for ladies, although I don't believe it should be expected for ladies to have incontinence, and that's another issue. But, you have babies, you know. But men is like, oh, my gosh, how I'm going to deal with this. And they don't know how to express that.
Mm-hmm.
They are different than us in the way they communicate. But just seeing the light in their eyes and seeing that, this is going to be okay. I was just very touched by that. Yes.
So you wrote a book.
Yeah.
It's called The Guide to Optimizing Recovery After Prostate Surgery. I've read it, and I can tell the listeners that it is an excellent, easy to understand resource. It's filled with practical information. It's got some great, art and imagery about the surgery, the recovery, how to treat incontinence and erectile dysfunction, other concerns about optimizing health around bladder and bowel function. Just a fantastic resource. It's definitely going in my waiting room at my clinic so that anybody who might be interested can maybe borrow it from us. I'll figure out how I'm going to make that work. Tell us what made you decide to write the book, and how has it been received, and where can listeners get their own copy?
Yes, so I always struggle with my handouts and trying to find reliable information where they can find that information. There are some good information, but I never liked when they talk about pelvic floor muscle training. And it's, you know, if you go online and you Google pelvic floor muscle training post prostatectomy, it's all they talk about is Kegel, how much you have to squeeze, how many times a day. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, that's not really.
On.
Oh, those Kegels.
Yeah. So anyway, so I never had a place to send these guys to read more about that material. And I always thought, like when I worked in public, I actually contacted the prostate program in Vancouver, and we said, like, why don't we combinedly try to draft something together and have something that is kind of, you know, aligned, so then everybody can get the same information, because that information is different from practitioners as well, right? And he said, that's a great idea, but that never happened. So then when I left the public practice, I contacted a nurse continence advisor that did a lot of work for these men, and she's very, very knowledgeable. But she was retiring, and she said, I don't want to do this, Sam. Sorry, I'm done.
Yeah.
So then, you know, I was traveling, and I was by myself without my kids, and I had a long flight, and I started writing the book. And it just came so quickly, and I was like, okay, maybe I'm supposed to write this book. And
that moment, I guess it's me.
And I find that having something, you know, words are, and they can be, they can be captured in so many different ways. But when you're actually telling someone that is worried about something else and it's worried about treating the cancer, that doesn't translate well in that circumstance. So if I tell someone, like an information, and then they have something to back up with a book to read about it after, they assimilate much, much better. And another thing that I said, you know, why not send this information to every man in the world that speaks English right now, because I haven't translated it yet. So it's a reliable source. I know there's a lot of clinical experience involved. There's not a lot of research-based material in terms of incontinence and prostate cancer surgery, but there's also a lot of common information that if they know about that, their anxiety level will decrease and they will do better with their recovery. So it's not really a magic book that's going to help them be dry. Mm-hmm. That's not the intention of it. The intention of it is give them as much information as possible and give me, this is how healthy bladder works. And that's what you want after the surgery. So then those behaviors that are usually not behaviors that will help that recovery will actually be addressed by reading the book and trying to kind of follow something more healthy and looking at a holistic approach to health and all that.
Fantastic. Where can our listeners get their own copy?
So it's at Amazon Books, and you can go Amazon.com, at Amazon.ca, Amazon.uk. So it's you can get a hard copy, and you can also can get
The Kindle
yes.
book.
And also what I'm doing to disseminate that is actually contacting urologists and pelvic health specialists to see if they can actually carry the books in their office so then they can sell it or give it to their clients. And so some of the local urologists are actually carrying my book because I sell them packages for cheaper, so then they are able to and all that.
Sounds like that might be a useful resource in a Pilates studio too.
Oh,
you just never know. So, Sam, I just want to ask you a closing question. In your perspective, what is health?
That's a very deep question.
I know, right? I'm leaving it right to the end.
Yes. Okay, so for me, health is not just physical. For me, health encompasses so many things, emotions, mental, spiritual. It encompasses meaning of the individual feeling that they are part of something. It encompasses friends. It encompasses family, being content in some moments, because it's not possible that you're always going to be content.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But if you're not content, you have the ability to ride with it and then come out of that in a healthier way.
Some resilience.
Yes. I also believe in healthy habits, making sure that they love themselves. So they want to love their body. They want to treat their body with respect, treat their brain and mind with respect, and being tuned when something is not right, so then they can be addressed. So, yes, it's pretty big. Health is pretty big.
It's big and broad. We're discovering that. The more conversations we have.
Just how broad it is.
Sam, we want to thank you for doing the work that you do in the area of pelvic health for men. Please keep up everything you're doing. And thank you so much for joining us today for our small conversation.
Well, thank you for giving me this opportunity.
That's the end of this small conversation. Links to Sam Hughes Physiotherapy will be found in the show notes, as well as notes on where to find her book, The Guide to Optimizing Recovery After Prostate Surgery. And I'm also going to include a link to the prostate cancer support groups. We will see you next time, and we will have the coffee on. If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us to help broaden this small conversation.